Live from Hollywood, California, it's The Rick Savage Show.
It is The Rick Savage Show. I'm your host, Rick Savage. Thanks for tuning in. If you're first time listening to this show, apologies for the ridiculous intro. That's just how we do it. It's absurd. And that's how we like it. I am so excited for today's episode. I talked for about an hour with Tom Mullen. Tom has a million projects going on. He's worked in the music industry for 20 plus years, I think, 25 or so. He runs a website called washedupemo.com. I highly recommend you check it out if you're a fan of the music of that genre. He covers old bands. He covers new bands. He has a great podcast also called Washed Up Emo. He has a kind of funny website called isthisbandemo.com where you can put in band names and it'll tell you yes or no whether they're emo with a comment or two. It's very entertaining. It's a great time killer website. And he's been doing Emo Night NYC since 2011. He started his website in 2007. 2011 started doing Emo Night NYC. So can you guess that we talk a lot about emo music? It's a great conversation. We talk about wonderful bands like Jimmy Eat World and Refused and Helmet and some of the great interviews he's done and some of the cool things over his career. He's got an amazing story about seeing Refused right before they broke up. And he's just an all-around great dude. And I wanted to talk to him about this scene. I also wanted to talk to him specifically about the Emo Night NYC that he started. There's a bunch of those across the country, across the globe now. Some of them are great. Some of them maybe not so much. So it was cool to hear his take on a lot of that stuff and the history behind the night that him and his friends started way back in 2011. Still going strong. I think they do it like once or twice a month now. So if you're in New York City, definitely check out his Emo Night NYC. All right, that's it. Follow me on the socials at Rick Savage. Please leave a review if you enjoy this, and if it's your first time listening, go ahead and hit subscribe, all that kind of stuff. All right, I hope you have a great week. I'll talk to you soon, and here's my interview with Tom Mullen. Okay, see you later. Bye. I don't think I know like where you're from, like where you grew up. What's your background?
Grew up in Vermont. Do you know where that is?
I'm familiar. Yeah.
Some people don't. Yeah, grew up in a small town, really, really small. And then when I was right before middle school, moved to a little town closer to the biggest city in Vermont, Burlington. I moved about 40 minutes east. And my parents were teachers, and my dad's taught in the school system. And so really small place. I was recycling when I was in middle school. I thought everybody had a farmer's market. I never saw a cop car. I didn't even know what that was. Really, really safe. Super cold. The seasons are fall, winter, spring, July. It was a really nice place to grow up. And there was a great club in Burlington, a teen center called 242 Main. Mm-hmm. And 242 Main was started by Bernie Sanders' wife.
Yes.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders was the mayor of Burlington for a very long time. And so his wife started this teen center. And again, it wasn't a punk place. It was a place that, they had kids stuff during the day. And so Bernie's wife started this and way before I started going. But that was where I first started to realize that there was stuff other than the radio, other than what was on MTV. I didn't have cable for a really long time. I didn't have Fox. Like, we didn't have a Fox affiliate in Burlington until like toward the end. Like, we were one of the last like cities or DMAs, if everybody knows what that is, that we had that. So very kind of sheltered, didn't really know. And then so to be able to see these touring bands and see people from New York and Boston come up and play and see their distros, that was, so eye-opening. And it kind of started this floodgate, and it's kind of the reason I'm sitting here.
Yeah. And what years was this? Like ballpark?
90s.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, yeah, like mid-90s to was when I was really starting to kind of go and either get rides or when I had a license I could drive and do myself. But it was, you know, there was a great record store called Pure Pop that is still around down in Burlington that was also had a bunch of records. And again, you know, for me, it started with Nirvana, and I think that was such a great opening. There were other shitty bands that I liked before. I mean, I literally saw Smells Like Teen Spirit on MTV, and I just went upstairs and I was like, I need a guitar. You know, again, they were into such cool bands, and they had, you know, things you could collect, and so I got really into, you know, finding everything about them and the records and books, and it just kind of opened up where you started getting fanzines, and then you started getting those distros, and then it was kind of from there off to the races. But I was so, especially being so isolated, you know, having time to spend and read through reviews or read through distros was my education. You know, it was me reading the history books. If you're doing that for anything else.
Yeah, and it was before the internet, so you actually had to put in the legwork, right? Like, it wasn't just a click away to find the cool new band.
Yeah, and it was, you know, talking to people, and the band that played, that had the distro, you told them what you liked, and they mentioned, hey, go check this out, or hey, if you really like this label, you would love this label. And I was insatiable. Like, I couldn't have enough. Like, I couldn't find enough about a band or the scene or a label and just devour everything that I could. And I think that education has helped me throughout, because half, or I don't even know what percentage, of those bands that I was obsessed with, or at least found out about, I've either connected with the label, talked to the band, helped them, worked with them. So sometimes when people are like, how'd you get into music? And I was like, I just always. I mean, it was from the first moment. It's why I can speak eloquently about a scene or a band, is because it wasn't just, I didn't just read it. I was there. And I think that's partly why I'm still in the music industry, because I'm able to sort of, I think that's a huge skill that people sort of sometimes look over, that look, people are really successful and they sit in their offices and they're just big music fans, but I got to be in it. And I think the education of a punk place, learning about labels like that early on and being in a place that I didn't have New York City. I had Montreal. I went and saw Rage Against the Machine up there during the Evil Empire tour, and it was one of the top 10 shows I've ever seen. And so, like, I definitely saw some of that stuff, but it wasn't until college that it exploded even more.
You know, I do like what you said, that you kind of have to live it, because every time, and I don't want to say any names, but every time, like, another former manager or record label exec, they launch this, like, online how to work in the music business type school, and, you know, they're going around and speaking on panels, or for $400 you can get all my lessons of how to work in the music business. And at least in my experience, it's similar to yours. I mean, I started in 98, and it was just working for local sound companies doing sound for bands, and then it just kind of built from there and got into radio and everything. So there wasn't like, you know, if I apply for this right job, magically I'm in the music industry, you know, like you have to put in the work. And I think sometimes, or it doesn't even feel like work because it's something you love, and then hopefully it leads to a career where you can also pay your rent doing it, which is kind of the goal. And I think people skip that sometimes.
Yeah, or also they think that their first job is going to be the end all, or this is going to be the way that it's going to happen. And sometimes each job doesn't lead to the one you think, and maybe as you're in the one that you didn't like leads to the next thing that you do. I mean, I've had similar situations, and everything I've done that wasn't asked of me has led me to the next job. So anything that I did on my own, knowing that it was the next thing, or I did it because I wanted to, those things led to the next career move or the next job, not what I was told to do all day and then go home. So that other part of actually doing more, sometimes doesn't go over well, but it's how I've done it. It's how I've met other people and been able to expand what I've done. I also don't sleep. That's the other thing.
Yeah. Also, there's a lack of sleep. But besides that, yeah, I mean, I remember my first radio job. I was hosting a local music show in San Diego, and all I wanted to do was be, you know, a full-time on-air, whatever that, night jock, afternoons, whatever. And one of the guys that was kind of, you know, been around for a long time, he was like, you know what, it's arguably more important what you can do off-air. So learn how to do production, learn what your sales team does, learn, you know, all these things that are way in addition to what you signed up for, but that's how you like learn those skills and then take that to whatever your next challenge or project is.
Totally.
I have this theory that everyone has kind of, you know, what are your top five albums? And then you look back over your whole life. But I feel like there's three moments, or at least for me, that there was seminal albums that maybe aren't my favorite looking back, but made an impact. So for me, my examples while you think about that is, like I remember being 6 or 7 years old and hearing the Bruce Springsteen Born in the USA album, and it was like, oh, this is what rock and roll is, I guess, right, for my 6-year-old brain. And then when I got into middle school, I heard The Chronic from Dr. Dre, and although it scared me, it like completely opened my eyes to this whole other world of hip hop and rap music. And then I guess, I don't know, freshman or sophomore year, Dookie came out, and then Green Day led me to, you know, every other band, and then probably a lot of the bands we're going to talk about today. But I was wondering if you have that similar, you know, kind of three albums throughout your life that put you on the path of where you are.
Yeah, I would definitely say the first one would be Nevermind, for sure. As I mentioned earlier, sort of like seeing the video and getting that record. And that was definitely, I mean, it just led me on such a interesting trail of, you know, independent music and independent thought. And yes, it was poppy, but it was also, you know, very, very aggressive and super, super down with that. I'd say, you know, Helmet, Meantime, and, you know, that band, I was obsessed with, you know, drove to DC, stayed after to like wait for them for a photo, and got every import, every vinyl release, like I have the entire discography, like from their first 7-inch to, I mean, everything. And so obsessed with them. I mean, drove hours and hours to see them over and over again. And it led me, you know, to another trail because of AmRep, their first label they were on. And so that one led. And what's even funny is full circle, later on, I'm DJing one of our DJ nights. And my buddy Brian, who I do it with, told me, he introduced me to this other guy, Brian. He's like, oh, Brian, he kind of manages bands and he manages Helmet. And I was like, what? And I'm DJing and playing like Get Up Kids and all these bands. And I was like, hey, by the way, I'm probably the biggest Helmet fan. And he's like, shut the fuck up. You're not. And I was like, no, I'm the biggest Helmet fan. And so I started rattling off like all the t-shirts I had. Well, lo and behold, like now I sort of like help them. You know, if they're like, hey, we're trying to do this tour. Like, what do you think? What shirt should we reissue? Or, you know, what? And so it's not like a huge thing, but I'll get random emails about Helmet. And so, you know, that definitely is like a full circle moment. And I would definitely say if there's a third one, it'd be Jimmy Eat World's Clarity. That record, you know, is still one of my favorite albums of all time. It still sounds just as good as it did when it came out. That band and that record, like I said, in later 90s and when I was in college, was pretty epic. And so, yeah, probably those three were the cornerstones of where I sort of led.
Do you remember the first time you heard the term emo?
Yes, I asked that to everybody that's on my show. Yeah, it was a friend outside of one of the shows at 242 Main, and I think we were talking about Get Up Kids or something, and she was like, oh yeah, that's an emo band. I was like, what the fuck is that? And she's like, oh, it's this, and this, and then there's this whole other thing, Rites of Spring. And I was like, oh, okay. And then I started to get into screamo. Now, actual screamo, not the bullshit stuff that that come, you know, that came later. But actual like falling on the floor and no microphone and chaos. And so I got really, really into that stuff. And so, yeah, that was the first time. And I didn't expect to, you know, be doing this long or doing this specific thing. But it's been really fun after all that's happened to the word to be able to be a part of it after hearing, you know, someone randomly mention it and being inquisitive to find out what it meant versus having an assumption.
Right. Yeah, I think mine was someone gave me the Jimmy Eat World self-titled EP, which I think might have come out before Clarity. I don't know, but it had Lucky Denver Mint on it. And it was a buddy in a band, and he's like, "You'd love this band. They're an emo band from Arizona." And I was like, "Well, I don't know what that word is." And then, I mean, 20 seconds into Lucky Denver Mint, I was like, "I get it. This band is amazing. I'm gonna love them forever."
Totally.
Yeah,
that's great.
I have a question. So once you started, so you're part of the scene and going to shows and an obsessive fan, and then you start working. I think you and I maybe crossed paths. I think you were at TVT in the early 2000s. Is that right?
Yeah.
And then where did you go after TVT? Were you at Vagrant?
Well, it's interesting. I would say one thing. It's interesting to even begin. I first worked at Cornerstone, which was before the Fader even was a part of Cornerstone, the marketing company.
The promo service type.
Yeah, they were promo, but they're also doing digital. And so when I was about to graduate, a friend of mine that I was in a friend's band, I just made their website. This was before bands had websites, people. This was around the time of fan sites. And so my favorite band, which was a band called Shift, didn't have a website. And I said, let me make one. And so I made one. They found it. And we ended up being friends and going to see shows. And I connected with it. And the drummer, Samantha, was an amazing drummer. And she and I became really close. And she was like, oh, you want a job? Like, oh, my buddy started this new company. And I got an email, you know, emailed to them, and it was the least amount of money, no health insurance, but I knew it was the best opportunity. And I knew it was the where I could make a lot of friends quickly being that kind of company. So that was my first gig. But again, it came from doing something else during college when you think you're really busy. You're actually not.
Yeah. You actually have a lot more time than you think.
Yeah. You have so much time. And so that was the, you know, the start of it. And I think, 3 months in, I found out that TVT, one of the metal guy, rock guy for College and Specialty, actually all College and Specialty, not just metal and rock. He was going to leave to a new thing called Sirius. And that was Jose Mangan. So I took Jose's job at TVT. And so, that was my first gig doing College and Specialty at that label from September 2000 until like, you know, mid 2004. So that was the first gig. And then I left after I was doing digital as well on top of specialty and radio in college because I got bored. I did. I left to work at Equal Vision Records, which was the label I grew up obsessed with. One of the labels that I found. So Equal Vision was a label that Shift was on, and I became obsessed with their label and every release, and ended up being the head of marketing for 3.5 years, which was really, really fun. I didn't make any money, but I connected with so many bands and broke a ton of stuff. I cold called MTV and got our videos played on MTV2. Fuse was playing videos then. I was cold calling, you know, video game companies and getting stuff in games. Like, it was just one of those, like, we knew we had great music. And so that was a really, really fun time. And it was only 7 of us. So I learned how to do everything. I had done sales. I had done radio. I had done video promo. I had done anything. And it was great to not be at a major label to start, because TVT was the same way. It felt like an indie, but you could kind of learn from every department. The same thing at Equal Vision. I kind of did everything instead of, oh, you're the promo guy, we'll just do promo for 20 years. And I know that's not everybody, but I knew I needed to learn a bunch. So long story short, TVT was kind of the first great indie label for me to kind of learn about everything. And then Equal Vision, I put it to the test.
So is that like early Coheed, circa Survive, like that kind of era? Does that Say Anything yet? Yeah,
No. Say Anything was after, toward the tail end of me, but this was 04 to 07. So this was Armor for Sleep. This was Circa Survive, Chiodos, Fall of Troy, band called Bear vs. Shark. It was super, super fun. I mean, we had two bands headlining Warped Tour. I think it was 05 we had two bands, or 06. It's all melding together. But we had, you know, two bands headlining. And so it was, you know, really great to be in that and break something from nothing. Because Coheed, I later worked in Keeping Secrets at Cornerstone. I went back to Cornerstone and went back to do digital for them, and in a different role, and got to work Coheed. And it was fun kind of to know that I helped, you know, in part break or, develop things, because a lot of times you're not, you know, you're sort of taking something that was already big. But Coheed, I remember the first time they played me the first record. And I just remember being like, this sounds like nothing else. People are going to start copying this. Same thing with Circa. When I heard Circa, I was like, wow, everyone's going to be copying this pretty soon. So it was really fun to be on that side and be on the cutting edge.
That's so cool. Yeah, I mean, Coheed's one of those bands that on paper almost doesn't make sense. Like, if you described what that band sounds like, I don't know if people would immediately jump at it. And then the first two or three albums were just insane, and then seeing the live show was like, oh yep, I get it, I get what's happening.
Yeah, I remember Kevin Lyman calling Equal Vision, I forget who it was, Dan, the GM, or Steve, the owner, and I think I remember this correctly, but that he called to say that the stage they were on for whatever show, it moved because there were so many people trying to see them, and they needed to move them to a bigger stage during Warped Tour. So it's just cool to, you know, hear that. And again, this was still message boardy. This was still commenting on a news item on Absolute Punk. This wasn't the back and forth of Instagram. Twitter wasn't even around, or barely. I mean, it started in late 2006. So that wasn't even, and that was text-based. So really, really cool to, kind of see that part happen when I was there.
So I remember, so I was born in Chicago. I lived there for not that long, and then moved to San Diego and kind of grew up in San Diego, and that I became kind of part of that music scene and played in a couple shitty bands, and all my friends were in much better bands, and then, you know, it went from there. And I just remember, by the way, that's 2 hours south of Los Angeles, but still, the idea of signing a record deal for any of my friends' bands was insane. It was like, it's like not even winning the lottery, really. It's just something that doesn't happen, right? And then once I got to the other side, and you reminded me, because I started working at Warner Brothers when we signed Armor for Sleep, and that was an era, you know, when a lot of the Used, Taking Back Sunday, My Chemical Romance, all those bands were blowing up, and then all the other bands that sound similar all got record deals. And then being on that side, I was like, oh, it's just luck. Like, there's so many great bands that don't get out there, that don't get the record deal. It's not necessarily the best band rises to the top. A lot of times, at least when I saw from the inside of Warner, I was like, you know, it's flip a coin, and if you get the right fan in the building, you'll somehow get a record deal. Did you have a similar reaction once you were on kind of the other side, going from a fan to working at these labels?
Yeah, I think the way that I saw it happen, and where a label would, you know, it would be the sampler, and they would be pushing this one band and trying to get them on a tour with them to make them connect. And I saw it turn. You know, I saw a band open a tour that by the end of the tour, they were bigger than the headliner. Just watching that and seeing what I thought was what these things were, and just watching the people kind of swoop in and say, oh, it's this. Okay. Well, let me just get this guitar and this person. And then all the kids that were maybe in, I don't even remember what was right before it, but whatever the thing was, like the New York City, like Strokes thing, all the bands and kids that sounded like Strokes bands then saw the emo stuff and was like, well, let me just go do that. And so those bands started to do it, and some of those got popular. And it angered me to the point where I started a website, because everyone wasn't talking about the bands that they actually were from, and it was nothing like it. And regardless of clothes and hair and how you put makeup on, the sound, it was as if the genre started when those kids woke up. And difference, when I told you about the distros, I realized that there was something before it. And I went back and looked, whoa, this is Agnostic Front. Cool. Okay, that's okay. Got it. They're from New York, blah, blah, blah. Or, oh, this is this label. You know, this label from DC is this. And now, but I, again, there was not everybody was like this, but for the, because it hit mainstream, because it hit MTV, because radio was playing it, the kids that were in the Strokes bands were now doing emo bands, and it was just as if it started, you know, October 2007. And I was frustrated by that, so I started the website late 2007 to sort of just talk about bands that were forgotten, literally forgotten. Like, you could have typed in Sunny Day Real Estate, you know, other than getting maybe Sub Pop's website, nothing came up. I mean, the line from the website was, I think I searched, wait, what was it? It's something to the sound of, I remember when I typed emo into a search engine and nothing came up. Like, I remember that time. And so I'm not saying it's a bad thing, because there were certain kids that definitely went back and listened to old shit, or the bands that got popular definitely referenced older shit. But this majority, this group of people literally thought it started, you know, the moment they woke up. And I thought to have people remember the bands before and also currently, because once it died down in 2009, which is fittingly 10 years from now, which I hope it happens again, it died down again. It was, you know, when I started in 2011, it was sort of reminding people about the current bands, because from 04, you know, I started a site in 07, it started dying down in 09, like the big spree. 10, you know, 10, 11, those bands were kind of forgotten. And then during that in-between time, there was this emo revival. And that was when I started to get excited again, to be like, holy shit, there's all these bands again, and they actually listen to like everything and they know the history. And so even the fans of the mid-2000s era didn't even know that the emo revival was happening. They kind of just left it off again. And you see that now. You see that now when the last few years, where it's like, are you nostalgic? Do you remember when you wore eyeliner? And unfortunately, they left emo in 09 and then went to techno or whatever else they were listening to, or went back to whatever was on the radio. And now they're back 10 years later because they're remembering their nostalgic time. Lo and behold, it's been going on the entire time. They just haven't paid attention. I mean, Taking Back Sunday, that's a bad example. I would say Fall Out Boy. Like, that band, obviously, when they came back, was huge. But Patrick Stump used to open shows to crickets when he was touring by himself. So where were those guys? Where were they? Where were you? Oh, you liked the song. So I think there's people that like a song. There's like there's people that like an album. And there's people that like a band or a scene. The people, unfortunately, a lot, because when you hit mainstream, they like songs. And so a lot of those people were songs. And I relate more with people that like a band or a scene. And that was what Washed Up Emo is.
That's perfect. That's a perfect wrap up. Yeah. It's weird because I don't want to, it's almost like a necessary evil. Maybe you disagree, but like, you know, when My Chem Breaks and I'm Not Okay comes out, and then Helena, and then just one after another of like, you know, I was at K-Rock at that time, like the biggest songs on arguably the biggest rock radio station in the country were My Chemical Romance, Fall Out Boy, you know, The Used would pop up there every now and then. Taking Back Sunday would pop up there every now and then. And that would get those kind of radio fans, right? But if it wasn't for that, you know, would the nostalgia even happen? Would other people go back and learn the history? And, you know, it happens, I think, with every genre. I mean, you know, you mentioned Nevermind and I mentioned Dookie, both of those albums, the hardcore fans of those bands at a time weren't very supportive. You know, I mean, there was a time that Green Day couldn't play Gilman Street, right? Because they signed to Reprise and Warner. So, yeah, I wonder if it's a necessary evil that you get some fans that become fans of the song, but the trickle down effect is kind of worth it, maybe. Does that make sense?
Here's the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. I've had this conversation, and the one thing I'll say to it is the genre punk. So when someone likes Green Day, they know NoFX, or they know something else, or they understand that punk was also the Ramones and also, you know, the Sex Pistols, Nirvana. You know, if it's grunge, they're going to know other stuff, or they're going to know other genres, or they're going to know sort of other bands. With emo, it was always a joke from the moment it was uttered in DC. It was a snide comment, and it's always marginalized. You know, emo was ridiculed in Pitchfork, absolutely ridiculed for years and years and years. And now, supposedly, it's okay. And I think that same sentiment where there's no other genre that was sort of raked through the coals and forever hated. No band I have ever interviewed has said, I love that I got the tag. They might say I'm okay with it. They might have a long answer. There's no one that is like, yeah, I'm an emo band, unless you're making a ton of money during a peak era of people following it from the mainstream. You know, that's the only time you're actually going to put yourself to it. And that's why a lot of the DJ nights came out kind of after, when they realized that people were, all they wanted to hear was, you know, nostalgic for the 2000s. That's what the nights are. The nights play Linkin Park. The nights play Papa Roach. They play pop music, hip hop, because they heard it after Taking Back Sunday. They heard it after My Chemical Romance. So it's associated with that. So, but they're using the marketing of emo, the word, because that's what those popular to mean all of those things. So, and again, I think that hurts the word as well. Because if I go downstairs right now to Times Square and ask 10 people, they're going to say what you and I most think what people are going to say about emo. Maybe one person says Sunny Day Real Estate. But if you talk about punk and I do the same thing down there, they're going to say Green Day. Some kid's going to say a new punk band. They're going to say Blink. They're going to say NoFX, or some old guy's going to be, you know, say the Ramones. So unfortunately with emo, that hasn't happened. And that's, again, the reason for the podcast, the website, the DJ night, is to talk about the whole history. I talk about Taking Back Sunday. Adam was in high school when I was in college in North Carolina. He was going to shows. We were at the same shows together. So I know those kids. I know all those bands. Like, I've talked about them. I've promoted them. They don't need any help. But I also talk about the new shit that happens today or this past week or this few years from now, and also the 90s and also the 80s. So that's only my mission, is that people think of the word, not just eyeliner, and they kind of giggle. It happens at work. There's people that ask what I do and they kind of laugh. They snicker after I say it. And I was like, why are you laughing? And they're like, oh, those funny bands with the makeup. I was like, actually, have you heard of this band? No. Have you heard of Foxing? Have you heard of, you know, have you heard of Top Shelf Records? Have you heard of Count Your Lucky Stars? Those are the questions. And I don't care if they want to listen to it, or if they don't even care if they're, I just want you to know that there was something else. And unfortunately for most of the groups, sitting in it for 25 plus years, the majority, you know, are just, this is just what happened, and I'm going to be nostalgic about it now, and then I'm going to leave it when I want to leave it. And I think for the word, it's been sort of left in to die sometimes, and I'm trying to be there to sort of keep it alive, but also help bands that are trying to talk about it today. But it is positively, it's still around. The word is still mentioned. The word is still talked about. There are bands. I get emails from Singapore and all over the world saying, hey, I started a band and this is what they sound like. And they reference bands from all across every decade. And it's great. So the word is still alive. I still think there's work to do, which was the original mission back in 2007, to be this sort of voice for the ones that have been forgotten.
I'm so happy I'm talking to you, man. I'm looking at my little notes here, and I have word for word, has anyone ever on your podcast said, yes, we are an emo band? And you kind of already answered that question. It's hilarious to me. So to make things clear, Emo Night in New York is a party you've done for, what did we say? 8 years now? Yeah, exactly. Okay. The other Emo Nights across the country and maybe the globe, you're not affiliated with. Fair to say?
No.
Right.
There are a few, and there's a history to it. There was a night in 2009 called Diary, and it was started in San Francisco, and this guy named Patrick, and that was one of the first ones that I'd seen. Yes, I'm sure people played emo music as a DJ thing, but to label it sort of as this thing, they were one of the first, if not the first. And then in January 2011, there was a Philly night that started, and we started in February of 2011. And so we were, and again, that sort of organic DIY, like, oh, you're doing this stuff. Cool. What did you learn? Do you want to DJ with us? Do you want to come up here? And slowly, a couple years later, we started getting a lot of people showing up and having amazing people stop by to DJ with us. And we got after parties, and we got every, you know, band that was in town to come by and hang out, and new and old, popular, not popular, just everybody would come by. And we, you know, slowly found out that, you know, again, the people sort of saw marketing. And they saw this sort of like, ooh, I can make money. And so there were a few people sort of being like, oh, I could do this and capitalize on the nostalgia, play 2000s music, just that, and, make some money on it. And there could be a whole podcast just about it, but just to kind of say, like, there's a lot of folks that wanted to make a lot of money from it and own a part of it. And no one owns the word. No one owns that phrase, and no one will. And I think that's the moral of it, that, you know, anybody can do a night. I have a Medium article that I posted about how to DJ your own emo night. And it teaches you everything from how to market it, what things to get, how to do it, what ways to sort of understand what to play. I mean, I do that every time I do it. I can look out in the crowd, and by the song I'm playing, I can tell what someone's age is, and I can know what record they like based on what that song was. So some people will come up all the time and be like, how did you know to play that song next? That's what I was going to request. And I was like, I know, because you know what to play. So from, you know, the DJ nights are a very interesting thing, and now they're worldwide and everybody's doing them. And there's some really great ones out there. Tampa's cool. Boston one's cool. And it's not just because they're cool with me. They like do things. They like have events. They post, you know, they host, local nights, and, you know, they do these things. But there, you know, there was one where it was from Florida, and a band told me this story where, and I won't tell what DJ night it was, but they told me that they were the early show because the promoter wanted to book this DJ night, and they were emo bands actually playing before. So they got bumped early. And then while the band was still playing, they were setting up their banner. So they didn't even understand that there was like a punk DIY emo bands playing. They were worried about their flyer or their banner going up for their night after, and had no idea or no inclination to meet the band or talk to them or maybe find out what's happening locally. And that was sort of where I sort of was like, you know what? These touring ones, you know, I think are tough because it's like you're not part of the scene. And I think you should have a local one be the, even if it is cheesy, or they play Linkin Park, you should at least have a local one. And I think that's why I think supporting like a local night is part of, I don't know, that's in my DNA too, for this is where you're going to develop that community. You're going to meet your friend that maybe you help put it on or flyer it or help out on promoting it socially. Those are the things that I see beneficial. So it's interesting to see what's happened. People have gotten older. You know, the songs that we play have changed based on the age that shows up. But yeah, we've been doing it either once a month or twice a month for 8 years. And it's been really, really fun. And we've met a lot of great people through it. And it's something that, you know, I don't need to make money on it either. So I'm not interested in touring. I'm not interested in just selling out and playing, you know, pop hits around the globe. That's not of interest for me. Other people may get a kick out of it, and it's something that turns into other things, but it's never been the motivation for me.
And by the way, if you want to throw a night and it's all 2000s music and some ironic pop songs thrown in there and a Papa Roach record, that's go nuts. Just don't call it emo night, right? Like, if you want to have a fun 2000s era party, cool, like no problem. But what I started noticing, and until I really learned about what you've done, was, you know, some local type nights here in town, you know, a lot of, I would see like Disney Child stars popping up on stage and singing along to whatever My Chem song or whatever. And it just seemed like, oh, you guys were the same people making fun of this scene 5 or 10 years ago. And now maybe it's a cash play, maybe whatever. But I looked at it as if I was one of the bands that you're playing, that you're almost playing ironically, not you, Tom, you like this night in Los Angeles I'm talking about. It just felt like very exploitative, and it didn't seem like it was coming from a place of loving the music or the scene or anything. And it just, I don't know, it just rubbed me the wrong way. I just kept thinking, like, if I was a band that's been like grinding it out on the road for all these years after, you know, maybe having a hit here or there, and then some bar is making all this money ironically playing my song, I'd be a little bummed about it, you know?
Yeah, and again, everybody has their own reasons, and everyone has their publicist on retainer that helps develop, you know, again, a lot of those press releases, you know, it says the original, the only one, the you know, and you know, they don't mention Diary. They don't mention that it's been ongoing for 10 years. And there's other nights all over the country. It's just like anybody else doing PR, you know, it's just like a car company or saying they're the best, or that's kind of, we've hit that point where they can have a retainer for, you know, things like that. So again, it's I'm sure they're making a lot of money, and everybody can make whatever they want, and it is a capitalistic society. It's just, again, the naming of it was always the thing that I was just really frustrated about. I'm like, well, if you're going to do that, you know, yes, you can play whatever mid-2000s thing you want, go crazy, but if it's when you start adding, you know, the hip hop and punk, or not even punk, like the, you know, the like pop stuff on top of it, when it's, you know, marketed a certain way. But I guess that's how it is. Everything's marketing, and they're using it as a marketing thing. And maybe I am too, you know, maybe I'm using it just as much, and fault to me too. I'm trying to go about it the right way and be teaching. You know, if someone comes up and they ask, you know, hey, what was that Coheed song? Like, I stopped, you know, I only listened to, the old records. I'm like, oh, it's actually a new song they released like a couple years ago. Like, oh, that's really cool, I'm gonna check that out. That's the win. And for me, that's the goal. So yeah, it's a very interesting thing that I could have jumped into, and I'm kind of glad I didn't, but also, you know, happy to be able to still do it on my own with a buddy of mine in New York City.
That's really cool. And you know, you're doing something from a good place, and that goes a long way. That's good for karma, man. You know, like that's a good way to handle things, I think. I have a couple more questions for you. Thank you for the time.
Sure.
K Can we talk about the Refused for a second? I don't know where they fall in their sound. I was just having this conversation the other day. Has there ever been a band, at least within our lifetime, that existed, was not popular, was not mainstream, well-known, was respected by a certain community, broke up, disappeared, and then came back to headline festivals? Has that ever happened before?
I feel like it has. We just haven't thought about it. I'm sure there was someone in the 70s or 80s that, you know, had came back and did, like, huge tours or reunions. I mean, no band breaks up. So it's definitely, you know, I'm definitely possible. I'm probably thinking right now of, like, who that might be. But I mean, I have a pretty crazy Refused story. So they were playing on that run. They were coming up the East Coast on the Shape of Punk to Come. And I remember getting promo cassettes from Epitaph and at the radio station. And I was like, oh, cool. Like, I love Refused. Like, I love their previous record on Victory with a song called Rather Be Dead. And so they were playing a college like cafe. And it was with Frotis and one other band. And I'm forgetting them, and I apologize to them. So they were playing, and I almost didn't go. And I was like, you know, I'll see you the next time through. Like, I don't know. And then my friend was like, dude, their new songs are, like, sick. Like, I think we should go. And so we ended up going. And a few days before, we found out they were breaking up. And so at the college radio station, Victory called me. Because they put out a record, you know, or one of their things. Equal Vision called me because they did their EP. Epitaph, you know, called and was like, hey, say goodbye to them for us. Like, and I you know, bands break up all the time. And I was like, cool, whatever. So I actually went up to the band. No one knew who they were. No one knew who they looked like because this wasn't like Wiki days. Dude, this was 150, not even. But it was jammed. But kids knew Rather Be Dead. Like, everybody knew the Rather Be Dead song. So I said goodbye to him. I saw the show. I bought merch. I bought a compilation CD because the record wasn't even out yet. And I bought a T-shirt that I still have, one of the few that I still kept. And that was it. And they broke up 2 days later. And so everyone's seen the DVD of their last show, you know, in Virginia, getting shut down by the cops. You know, I saw it 2 days before that. So I'm at TVT, and a friend who works at Matador was like, oh, I have some VHS tapes of Refuse. I'm a huge fan. I'm like, what? Which ones? He's like, I don't know, some show right before they broke up, like North Carolina or something. And I was like, what? Someone was filming the show? And so I ripped the VHS tape and put it up online. And people flipped because they hadn't seen like a full set, because that was the last full set they played. Their last show was cut short. So this was the full set. So it's got all the songs from New Noise, like most of them, like all the dance moves that, you know, he's done. And so it was amazing to watch, you know, in 2000 or 2001, whenever that was, to be able to see. Wait, no, what was that? No, even later. It was probably later. So I think I was sitting on the tape for years and then finally like ripped it and put it out. And then people were like, oh my God, this is crazy. And so I never thought they'd get back together. Never. It was always the one where I was like, there's no way they hated each other. I saw the last show, like 98, like they hated each other. And so, or not hated, it was just like, you know, band shit. And so for them to come back, and the most amazing part was, you know, for them to have that return. And I think I pray for that for bands that do reunite, to be able to have the sold out show, whether it be Bowery, whether it be whatever venue you know in town that's small or medium, you know, they could come back and do that. So for them to come back and headline Terminal 5, and you know, for us, and yeah, it was super fun. And the coolest part was I was backstage because I knew the manager, and we were hanging out, and a friend of mine was a show booker, and he basically had set up a venue ready if they wanted to do a after party show. And so I was in the room when they were like sitting there, and he was like, look, I've got the back line. You guys can play. We're going to tweet out that you're playing, and you know, you'll go on at like 2 a.m. And that you saw the band kind of look around, and they're old hardcore kids. Like, they love Civ. They love like real like punk rock hardcore. And that's a chance they could probably play some of those songs or covers, or, you know, do like an Earth Crisis song. And so, being a hardcore kid myself, like, you know, I was like, this is going to be insane. And so they kind of looked at each other and said, yeah, let's do it. So they got the van and they went out there. And then I followed with a box of t-shirts. And I was with the manager, and the guy that booked the show is yelling at me on the phone, and Mike being like, you guys got to get here. We got to start. I'm waiting for you. I'm waiting for you. And so there's a line out the door. We get there. We jump out of the cab, and I'm holding a box of t-shirts. He opens the door and yells, you know, 1, 2, 3, we're full, and they start. And it was 100 people, 110 people maybe. And then they just start, and it was just, and they filmed the show, and it was really fun. But like, just, you know, it went from, I saw their show, they're about to break up. I saw them headline Terminal 5 to sold out, to everyone screaming every word of a song they hadn't played live, you know, essentially for years, to that crew, to then go back to the root of it, to a punk show, you know, for the 100 people and stage diving and no bouncers. That to me was this full circle moment of, you know, this is why.
Yeah. I wonder, throughout your interviews on the podcast,
you didn't think I was going to say all that after you said refused, right?
No, but
I'm going to do is say refused.
But I'm really happy I did. I'm very happy I did. I mean, I thought it's a crazy story, a crazy career. And also a band that like influenced so many bands after that, that good for them for being able to come back. And
not even after, during. I remember reading Guitar Worlds, and every one of those bullshit like nu metal bands, they all referenced Shape of Punk to Come. And I'm like, really? You guys listen to that? All right. Like, cool. You know, and it was, so that it was like this bubbling up, you know. And I guess the only other one to, now that I think about it, would be American Football, because kids were starting to share that record and talk about it. And in my podcast with the founder of Polyvinyl, he talks about that, like talks about like having all these orders for the record and being like, what's going on? And I think, you know, them having not only two lives, but now, you know, being able to have a third record and it being even better. That's almost like, that's like the dream, like an amazing band that everybody loves, that everyone emulates. And then they come back, and now they're making new music that's actually better. Way into that. I want more of that.
Yeah, totally. That's very special. Throughout your interviews on the podcast, has there been anyone that you were going in a little nervous, unsure how it would go, and you were kind of either pleasantly surprised? I'm not looking for dirt the other way, where it didn't go how you planned. My example was, I interviewed Chris Caraba a couple times, and both times I was a little nervous. You know, I wasn't sure how he was gonna react to things, and he's a man with a clear point of view, I guess you could say. And both interviews came out great, and he was a sweetheart. And it was almost more in my mind that I was like, I don't know. And then I did, when I interviewed Trevor from Face to Face, same thing. I was like, dude, this guy doesn't take any shit. Like, if I ask the wrong thing, and he was awesome. It was so great. So I'm wondering if you left any interviews kind of pleasantly surprised with how they went.
Yeah, I think it was, for me, I do so much research like for these interviews, and I make sure that I don't ask what's been asked, and I try to have an angle and a story that applies to something a little bit deeper. And I think I've had a lot of people, you know, say that, like David Bazan was like, this didn't feel like an interview, like or I had someone say like, this felt like a therapy session, because I actually connected something in their family's history to what's happening now in their life. Not him, but somebody else. Those are things that I really, I love, and think that, you know, I'm pleasantly surprised a lot of times where someone will go on that trip with me. You know, they'll relax about 10 minutes in, you know, and I think me having a history in the genre. I worked at a lot of the labels. I know a lot of the bands. I'm able to kind of get, just like a band is really great at interviewing another band because they've done the same things. And so I've been in it enough where I'm able to ask those questions. And I think pleasantly surprised is when somebody was interested in what I was talking about just as much as I was interested in them. And I'm not saying I talked a lot, but they were interested in what I said. And I think that's when it really hits me a little differently, that I could tell that they care about it. I'm not saying people don't when they're answering interviews, but it hits another level and you sort of get heady. The perfect example is John Bunch from Sensefield, who passed away. And I did his last interview and I didn't know it was his last interview. And I was doing it because he had another band that wasn't Sensefield that I was wanting to help because I just liked. And literally the first 30 minutes is him just asking about me. And this isn't like an ego thing, but it just, I kind of was like, oh my God, I think I got to change up these questions. Like I was kind of like editing on the fly. I'm like, he's asking all things about me. We're already talking about that. Let me move this around. And I had to kind of think on my toes. And I finally was like, John, well, let's start talking about you. Let's talk about your stuff. And what was crazy is I edited it and then he passed away and I had to edit it because at the end he's like, I'll see you in LA. And I had to re-edit it and kind of get approvals and do all these things. So it was sort of I not only was taken aback by his just sweetness toward me, but also his having to do it for him because it was the last words that he had, you know, professionally kind of done in an interview setting, and he talked about his life. And so I was kind of doing it for his son, doing it for his family. So that was sort of he had kind of done it to me organically by making me feel good, and I knew I had to do it for him.
That's awesome, man. That's very special. Who's on your list of, you know, dream guests? I mean, you've got some pretty heavy hitters already, but who would you love to sit down with?
I just did one that I put up a few weeks ago with Ian MacKay. You know, outright hero from, I'm also Straight Edge, so, you know, him and being in Minor Threat and obviously Discord Records, DIY, that whole ethos, like that's what I subscribe to. So I had my buddy, my best friend from college, lives in DC. And so I was down there for his wedding and I just happened to kind of time an interview, and I had a few other connections to be able to kind of get connected with him. But we ended up having a great conversation on the phone, and then not even for the podcast. And then I went to the Discord house and got to see the archives and got to see a bunch of the stuff from it and got to hang out. And, you know, I was definitely nervous as hell. I mean, he is, you know, definitely a tough cookie. And so for me, you know, I kind of felt like after 8 years, I could like, all right, I think I can get up to do Ian. I think I'm ready. Yeah. So it was 8 years in the making. So that was really fun. There's a bunch of bands that I've emailed over the years, and slowly they, like Mitch from No Knife, I started asking him in 2015. We finally just did it. So, you know, I joke on the podcast and I joke about, even with him, with Jeremy Enig from Sunny Day, like he's the sweetest dude. He knows who I am. Like we've emailed, we've, you know, corresponded every time I see him. Hey man, you up for it yet? Nah, not yet. All right. He's like, I appreciate your persistence. You know, so some people aren't ready. So a lot of people are like, why haven't you had this person on? And, you know, either they don't want to or they're not ready. And I think that kind of makes it fun. So, yeah, there's Jeremy's probably the biggest one I'd love to have on and be able to have a conversation with. But it's a never ending mountain. I mean, if I even open up my list of who I want, if I have a two schedule thing, that's, geez, I don't even know how much numbers this is. This might be 25, 30 deep. That just is people that I need to have on or I've bugged and need to bug again. So it's fun. As of course, now I can just say I had Ian MacKay on, so you kind of have to.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, that'll get you in the door with just about anyone. Ian did it. And I went to the house, by the way. How was it? Was it incredible? I mean, he is an encyclopedia when it comes to that history.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. I mean, he opens up like his first tour book for Minor Threat that he did with Henry. And it's just like, here's our third date and we spent $9 and here's $10 on gas and we had this much for food. And it's unbelievable. And showing me, you know, the archives of music and how it's archived and, you know, all the photos. And yeah, it was absolutely, you know, amazing to see. And he schooled me too. Like, I forgot something and he like made fun of me for it. He's like, how do you not know that? Aren't you like the emo historian? And I was like, dude, I love it. Ian's giving me shit right now.
So great.
This is great.
That's such a badge of honor. Cool. Absolutely.
Yeah. Like, oh yeah. Grill me. I forgot it. I totally did. I'm an idiot. You know? So that was really fun. But I think too, the being able to have these be evergreen and have, you know, the website, you know, have news and all the social stuff, being able to share what's happening about these older bands like Appleseedcast, who's never broken up, you know, are still touring, still making music. They just put out an amazing record a few weeks ago and it's flawless. And I love, you know, that I finally got to talk to him. You know, I first asked him like 7 years ago. So we finally got to do it. So yeah, never give up. And I think, you know, keep doing it and these great relationships form from this stuff. And I'm able to sort of help and be able to assist. And, you know, Jimmy Eat World, for example, is my favorite band and been able to interview those guys. And you know, they were on a Sony label when I was working at Sony. So I was able to kind of have the insider knowledge or, you know, find out who was working for them and be able to help. And that was really fun. So that kind of makes it worth it. So the relationships, and you like with our industry, you know, it's we love music, so it just kind of continues that way.
My Jimmy Eat World story is at the tail end when they were at Interscope, and I don't think I'm talking out of school here, but I was at Vevo, the kind of music video site, and was producing a lot of original content, and so labels would always pitch us on stuff. And my friend at Interscope said, like, I don't know, do you want to do something with Jimmy Eat World? And I was like, absolutely. I at this point, I didn't really care how many views it got. It was my chance to do something with Jimmy Eat World. And so we went to Tucson with them, and we went to the studio, and I think like their favorite Mexican food restaurant, and just kind of hung out for a while. And towards the end of the day, I think it was Zach, we were talking. And I was like, how's things going at the label? And he's like, I just saw our A&R guy, and he was really excited about all the headphones they're selling these days. And I was like, oh, that's not a good sign. He's like, yeah, I don't think we're going to be at Interscope much longer. And then quickly they moved on, and I think they're much better for it. But they were just the nicest, sweetest dudes. It was definitely a highlight hanging out with those guys for a day in Tucson.
Oh, yeah. They the A&R guy for TVT, I've always messed with him about this. He handed me the Bleed American demos that they sent to every label. And he handed it to me. He's like, oh, you remember you telling me you love this band? Here you go. And it was the demos to Bleed American. And I remember listening to it and being like,
like, did you hear Sweetness? Give them all of our money. Sign this band immediately.
No, the middle. As soon as I heard the middle, I was like, oh, this is going to be huge. And I had a bet with one of the product managers. And he joked at me. He's like, Tom, they're going to sell 80 grand. They're going to play Irving Plaza and you're going to be fine. And no, they didn't. So that was one that I always loved to poke him about too. I was wrong about a lot of bands, but that one I was correct. But yeah, they and again, still going, still touring. I mean, I'm seeing them this weekend. And they have another record coming. So I love that. Like, I love knowing that a band is still around because I can go hear them. So that's why I go. That's why I pay the ticket. I'm not just going to – a lot of the – we didn't talk about this, but, you know, seeing Taking Back Sunday, who I love, like, unfortunately, a lot of those fans could care less about the new record. And one of the last times I saw – previous times I saw Taking Back Sunday, they played their whole new record front to back at the beginning before they played the hits. And I was like, I love that troll. I love it. You know, like, you got to sit through our jams before you get, you know, the bangers. So
yeah.
I love that rule.
Yeah, I think and that's fair. I think that's a fair trade. You know, if you just want to see Q without the E, that's cool. But we're going to go through the record first. I went to one of the shows where they flip the coin on what album to play.
Oh, I love that.
It was so great. I thought it was awesome. They played two nights at the Palladium, both nights. I guess technically the first night wasn't sold out, but just about. And then they sold out the second night. And I was like, I just love the fact that this band can still be selling out two nights at the Palladium, and kids are going nuts. And some of them were there just for the hits, and some of them were, you know, singing along to all those songs in the, that weren't on the radio. And it felt pretty nice. I love those guys. So cool, man. Well, again, thank you so much for hopping on the phone and chatting. Hopefully we can stay in touch.
Sounds good. Thanks so much, Rick.
Your lipstick is colored up by the angel. I know exactly what goes on.
This is the Rick Savage Show.
Capital One presents a 30-second audio tour of Ireland. Sheep, fairies, golf, charming castle.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, you can actually go there when you use the Capital One Venture Card. You earn unlimited double miles on every dollar you spend on every purchase, which means you'll have plenty of miles to actually travel to Ireland. The Capital One Venture Card. What's in your wallet?
Capital One Bank USA NA.